Hey, everybody. As the co-host of your Chillpack Hollywood Hour, it's always delightful to shoot the transatlantic breeze with the UK Midweek Drive team. Together, we aim to provide the best possible audio backdrop for political sanity in the 21st century. This is Phil Lairness, reporting from the middle ground between science and superstition. And you have entered the podcast zone.
Well, change and the kind of elements that we've been going through with respect to the pandemic understandably will have a lot of impact on people's particular mental well-being. And with today seeing the inaugural launch of the first ever report into the state of the psychotherapists of the nations, you might find some interesting results coming through, particularly when you've got literally a little under 5,000 psychotherapists actually analysed for this. Accordingly, we're delighted to actually welcome the Deputy Chief Executive of the BACP, that's the British Association for Counselling and Psychotherapy, with us today, also Chief Professional Standards Officer at the aforementioned BACP. It's Fiona Ballantyne-Dykes. How are you, Fiona?
Hi, Alex. I'm in good shape, thanks. Nice to be with you.
That's fantastic. It's always an interesting line when you ask a psychotherapist how they are, because you can get to all sorts of interesting lines. So let's progress to this report, though, because there are some interesting positives about this in terms of, understandably, a lot of people have been suffering signs of depression, aspects relating to, I suppose, not being able to cope with changes and all the things that we've been going through. But it's not all bad, is it?
No, you're quite right. One of the interesting findings when we canvassed our members, we have actually over 58,000 members, so even 5,000 is a massive response rate, is that the actual ability to access therapy because of remote therapy being offered has really opened up all kinds of opportunities for people. It's made it much more accessible to people, communities that wouldn't normally find their way to a therapist's room. And that's meant an increase in, say, young people and men accessing therapy. And another key thing is it offers a much wider choice of therapist. Now, this is really important for people from particular communities or with particular issues they wish to discuss. And it means they can choose from a wider pool of people, of qualified therapists. And we know from the research that that actually leads to better outcomes. So that's good. The cost is also potentially less if you haven't got to travel. And we know that some people I've been able to attend more regularly because they haven't got the logistics of getting to a room. So it's here to stay, remote therapy, or some kind of hybrid version anyway. And that's all to the good.
And certainly allowing for that, it does open up a whole range of aspects in terms of the needs that we have as human beings to connect. And clearly, systems via Zoom, whether you actually go for Zoom fatigue or whatever, it's still a way of actually making that connection, of actually sort of seeing something which you couldn't really do over a telephone call, and which in many cases you would need to actually sort of have a kind of in-person approach to take.
Yeah, I'm a therapist myself, and I move my practice online. And I think it's been a really interesting experience to sort of dispel some of the prejudices, maybe, that it's somehow not as good. It's been incredibly effective, and it is possible to build a deep therapeutic relationship with someone online. There are certain things you have to pay closer attention to, and it's not suitable for everybody. But generally speaking, it's just opened up access. And of course, that's one of BACP's main, you know, asks, calls to action, if you like, from the impact of this report. You know, we're seeing such immense increase in demand and increase in some of the problems people face. So, to name some of the obvious ones, anxiety, trauma, stress, massive effect on relationships and breakdowns in relationships, sometimes tipping into domestic violence, a rise in addictions, internet dependency, complex needs and a huge amount of issues around loss and grief, not just from the huge number of people who've died, but also because of redundancy and you know, issues around furlough and so forth. So social isolation and loneliness, we know, has been a massive feature. So we know the need is there. Our therapists are working at 80% full capacity. And there's, you know, it's not going to be easy to meet this demand unless we have real investment from the government.
You've raised a number of important issues there with respect to the illustrative aspects of people suffering from poor mental health. And again, it's something that most folk at some time will undoubtedly either suffer, as Churchill once said, the black dog of depression, or some sort of way which kind of impacts on that. But do you think that actually within the 21st century, we are getting to a stage where people do feel a little bit more comfortable in at least being able to express the fact that they are not necessarily hyper all the time, that actually they are feeling challenges, and that actually it is, to use the classic cliche, good to talk about that?
Absolutely, Alex. We know from that particular Mindometer report, 72% said people were more open to therapy. And we've had a reciprocal type of responses from our public attitude survey. It's less stigma attached to it. It's much more seen as a kind of normal way to kind of deal with issues. And they don't always have to be people in acute difficulty. It might be that the whole effect of the pandemic on your family and your relationships is a time to reflect and reevaluate how you want to live your life. And we know that counselling does change lives in that respect. It's a safe space to have mm-hmm. those sorts of explorations, as well as dealing with some of these really serious problems that people have. So, yeah, normalising and just sort of part of how we recognise our own mental health difficulties, which is a common thing.
Classic line being healthy mind, healthy body, I suppose. Those two things do work in tandem. I mean, clearly one of the routes is through understanding one's inner self. And if we can seek answers from within, that can be very useful. What particularly attracted yourself, Fiona, to the psychotherapy world?
Well, it started very young, actually, Alex. I tried to support a school friend who was going through very, very severe depression and hospitalisation, and sort of got drawn into that kind of world of just feeling de-skilled and unable to know how to help. And so I joined the Samaritans as a very young woman, and it's always been a passion, a brief foray into another career in international affairs, actually. I came back to my roots, which is people, relationships, and how to help and bring a sort of a lens to each individual's difficulties and really try and connect with them to help them sort things out.
And presumably from your own experience, you'd also suggest that if people are looking to work within the health service area, this particular zone is one that can be very rewarding.
Can be very rewarding. I mean, it is really important that you find a therapist that is properly qualified. And, you know, it is quite a jungle out there when you're searching on the internet. So I would strongly recommend that people look for a therapist that is on a professional standards authority register, like the BACP's own register. And if you go to our website, which is www.bacp.co.uk, then there's also information on how to find a therapist, how to search our directory to find the person that you feel comfortable working with. And the sorts of questions you might ask a therapist if you were, you know, going to your first session. So it's a really supportive website to find out more about it and to dip your toe in the water if it's something you've not tried before.
Our classic line, man proposes, God disposes, might be the response to the next question. But in terms of looking ahead, Fiona, do you think that given that more than half of BACP members maintain that we'll continue to see the impact of the pandemic having clear signs on people's mental health for up to 5 years, do you think that's a sort of realistic sort of aspect? I mean, it does take a lot of time to actually work through this, and sometimes, you know, that's the last thing we have. Of course, there might be something else just around the corner that might sort of be just about to sort of strike. Who knows?
Indeed. Well, I mean, we've got various calls to action. One is campaigning for more counselling and psychotherapy to be available in the NHS, but also in our schools. We don't yet have a counsellor in every school in England. We do in Wales, Scotland and Northern Ireland. Access to counselling in the workplace and increased access, particularly for underrepresented communities where it's perhaps not so much part of the culture. So all of those things are about trying to make sure that if therapy is the right thing for somebody, they have access to the right kind of support from qualified practitioners.
And of course, therapy can include counselling, coaching, as well as, of course, the psychotherapy as well from that point of view.
Have therapists who coach on our register as well, and they do some really important work.
Absolutely. We mentioned obviously the website bacp.co.uk. You can also presumably find out about the Mindometer report there if people want to drill down and find out some of the other findings that we've talked about this morning.
Yeah, there's lots of details, including the effect on therapists, which is perhaps an angle we don't hear so much about. But, you know, the overall thing is about how we prepare for the future and be part of the solution to what we see as the challenges ahead.
That was going to be my closing question, Fiona. Who actually counsels the counsellors? I mean, is there a sort of system that's in place for that? Because clearly there is that classic value. You think, you've got problems, you should listen to me.
Well, there's a wonderful kind of method we have within the profession, which is about supervision. And supervision supports counsellors, and supervisors are supported by supervisors. And although it sounds a bit mad, it provides a really important reflective space for practitioners and a real ethical insurance for clients that we are well cared for and we can support ourselves so that we can be available to others. And that's kind of how it works.
Fiona Valentine Dykes, Deputy Chief Executive and Chief Professional Standards Officer with the BACP. Many thanks indeed. Keep on keeping on and stay well.
Thanks, Alex. Nice to talk to you.
Back in the day when I was a biology undergraduate at London University, of course, I always used to recognise the notion of enzymes by ending in A's, or organic catalysts that effectively did wonderful things. You got your amylase, you got your lipases, you got all sorts of things with respect to A's. But who would have thought that we'd actually have a plastic eating enzyme that's also being formed in the 21st century? Or to talk us through this, and indeed how that's been developed as part of a diamond solution to all sorts of other bits and pieces, we're delighted to welcome the Chief Executive Officer from indeed the Diamond Facility. That's Professor Andrew Harrison. How are you, Andrew?
Very good today, Alex. Delighted to speak to you.
Good. So share with us, Andrew, because I was literally just a few weeks ago listening to an audio of the Twilight Zone, which was also dealing with nanobots who effectively would actually eat all this plastic up and be the ideal solution, etc. Well, it's not nanobots, but it's all an organic sort of solution here, which sounds relatively, well, very exciting when it comes to the challenges of the environment.
Absolutely. So the story starts actually in Japan, where it was discovered that the bacteria living in landfill sites had adapted their life cycle to be able to feed off the plastic. And what we at Diamond do is we allow researchers to look at the greatest detail at how bacteria, in fact, how any material is made up down to the atomic level. And a team of researchers based out of Portsmouth, John McGeehan and his team, discovered that within the bacterium, there is an enzyme, as you've introduced, which had been adapted to specifically break down particular plastics in the landfill and then contribute to the bacterium's life cycle. Not only did they do that, but they also found a way to improve the efficiency of the activity of this natural catalyst or enzyme within the bacterium. So in principle, what this can now do is allow this process happens naturally along within bacteria to be industrialized. So it opens the door to massive recycling of plastic, whether it's in landfill sites, or you could imagine harvesting all those microplastics in the oceans and then converting those plastics back to the raw materials so that you can make them into other things.
Well, I used to say that technology got us into the challenge. Maybe technology can get us out of it. So it's good to see that that looks to be at work. But let's move on to the Diamond Facility. I mean, this is something which I must admit I was woefully ignorant about, but it's the world's leading centre in terms of scientific breakthroughs, etc. It's the size of 6 football pitches. And it's home, again, to the wonderful synchrotron. Which again carries with it. I mean, is this our answer to the CERN accelerators and various other sort of things that we actually got there with respect to other areas? Is this Britain saying, yeah, you might have that sort of particle accelerator there, but we can bring this in as well?
Actually, the connection with CERN is an interesting one because at our heart, we have the same kind of accelerator, but rather than using it to look at fundamental physics, we use it to generate brilliant light. So in Diamond, which you said is huge, it's actually about the size of Wembley Stadium. We generate light that's 10 billion times brighter than the sun. And that enables us to serve a suite of ultra-powerful microscopes that let us look at the structure of materials down to where the individual atoms are, or for that matter, the molecules in your body. So if you want to get insights into disease, one of the critical things is to understand how disease affects the molecules in your body. And that's one of the first steps to enabling scientists in universities and industry to develop new drugs to tackle those diseases.
And presumably, I say, without the sort of harmful side effects that the old electron microscopes would use, where you could actually put samples under the electron microscope, but then you'd kill them. So it was a pretty big problem from that point of view.
Well, actually, in all fairness, you do have to extract the molecule. So at the end of the experiment, you have destroyed the molecule. But in doing so, we don't do in vivo experiments. We don't put real people under the beam. We would take samples out of their body and then do the measurements on them.
But it does, again, show that importance of actually being able to understand and to really analyze. And again, just as you know, we'll talk about analyzing in order to synthesize, really, to actually break down and then understand and then sort of really build the thing back up. So in terms of the Diamond Center, I mean, you must feel a sense of pride, you know, on a daily basis in terms of some of these tremendous things that are coming out.
It's wonderful. And it's incredibly varied because, you know, what we're providing is tools to do something really basic, looking at where the atoms are in materials, whatever those materials are. So you can apply the synchrotron to pretty much any kind of problem where at the heart you need to understand where the atoms are. So if you want to develop better batteries that fade so quickly, you need to look inside the materials of which the battery is made, just as if you want to understand how the virus response for COVID-19 is changing. What are the differences between variants? Well, what it often boils down to is, what are the different arrangements of atoms in those variants? So all of these problems start fundamentally with being able to measure where the atoms are in the material. And yet, as you say, it's a tremendous contribution, but across this incredible wave of science. So you get a real kick out of seeing people coming from all over the UK, actually from all over the world. So far, we've served 14,000 scientists bringing their very different problems and going away with solutions.
Again, just looking at some of the numbers, and we're not going into number crunching too much, but collectively, you've created patents that have been worth over £10 billion. A research output, and Lord knows I'm familiar within the university world with research outputs and the line of that, but just a little under 10,000 articles have been produced. Yeah. A cumulative impact of over £670 million. I mean, these are substantive figures, which, again, I think folk probably exist in ignorance of in terms of the tremendous work that you are actually doing.
Yeah, and the bottom line, just very recently we published a report which essentially addressed the question, what has the value of diamond been to the country in terms of addition to the economy? And also, let's be honest, it's not just about the benefit to the economy, it's how we've improved people's lives. You know, what value producing a drug for depression, for example? Yes, of course, the companies make money, but at the same time, you transform lives. But so this report tried to put the contribution of diamond into monetary terms. And the bottom line was 1.8 billion since we started running in 2007. And that's very much an underestimate because you've got all those companies whose profits have improved, but for whom this is commercially sensitive information. Oh. So getting that information out of them is difficult to the point we can't get reliable numbers. So 1.8 billion is a very conservative estimate.
Were you ever tempted to actually name the company graphite as opposed to diamond? It's a carbon allotrope joke. I just thought I'd put it in there. Yeah, just did that line.
I still think diamond works because it produces radiation. It's hard and bright, and that was the fundamental reason.
It's the way in which allotropes can actually function. But still, let us go on to another little line, which is basically how can people actually access some of the work that you're actually doing? How can people find out more about the Diamond Lab?
Yeah, so in normal times, we would be welcoming thousands of people on our many open days. We haven't been able to do that in the last year or two, but what we do, if you go onto our website, www.diamond.ac.uk, you'll find a whole range of virtual ways that you can look at diamond. You can take virtual tours. And also what's really important is engaging school children and students at all levels. So we also put on a wide range of training and engagement courses so that people can come and see the science we do, but also actually start to interact with people here if they wish to make a career of science in this sort of area. So website is the first step for that.
Very exciting times. Okay, two final questions for you, Andrew. First of all, have you had a reasonably interesting Zoomer with us on the programme today?
Have I had a reasonably interesting Zoomer? Now, you're going to have to explain what... Gosh,
well, it's customer satisfaction. Awful. You know when you get a smiley face or a half smiley face thumbs down, etc. Has it been okay for you, Andrew?
It's been brilliant today. Absolutely, yes.
Well, then the next critical question is, can we prevail upon you to connect with us again? Will you come back and speak more Diamond Wonderment with us in the not-too-distant future?
Would be delighted to, Alex. Just, you know, anytime you've got time to talk to me, I'm here.
Professor Andrew Harrison, Chief Executive Officer of the Diamond Research Facility, or indeed the facility, the secret science lab that is out there and doing wonderful work and saving the planet, of course. Many thanks indeed.
Thanks, Alex.
There are enzymes that can munch through all of the plastic waste that actually is in our ocean. We've got two fine midweek drive-outs to actually join us to actually share their thoughts on this enzyme work of the Diamond Centre. Obviously, in North Carolina, we've got Jessica Burtis. How are you, Jessica?
I'm doing pretty well. How are you both?
Excellent. And of course, Robin Pierce in Wales, who probably actually will benefit from all sorts of enzyme munching scenarios. And curiously, I was literally just...
What do you mean by that exactly?
I will plead the Fifth Amendment, because I will say I was listening to an episode of The Twilight Zone, and listening because, of course, there's a whole range of Twilight Zone radio shows that were produced by Stacey Keach, who's, I think, the man behind the sort of the radio version of The Twilight Zone. But one of them actually deals with nanobots that actually do consume plastic. So it's an interesting way, again, of life imitating art and so on. Good news, do you think, Robin? Or is this just a case of, well, that's the Diamond Centre in the south of England. They're obviously playing with things they don't understand.
Okay, they'll eat through plastic. Now, that's great. That is a planet saver right there. What else do they eat? I mean, okay, let's... First thing, this is the first I've heard of this, okay? And the first thing that came to my mind was, what if Cher was swimming in the ocean? Would there be anything left?
That is harsh, Robin. Even for your good self, Robin, that's quite harsh. I think the idea is, just as we have amylase, which just deals with the saliva and breaks things down, they will break this thing down into manageable substances from that point of view. The fact that obviously she, who clearly has created so much magical musical memories, could be even stepping down that line, I think is very unfair, but never mind. Let's turn to Jessica. I mean, I've often said the line, technology got us into this challenge, so technology should get us out of it. What are your thoughts? Do you think that actually, yeah, this is good news?
I think, you know, it could be good. Obviously, plastic waste is a very big issue, and it's become unavoidable to not throw out plastic. Like, you have to, you know, but it makes me a bit worried that, you know, some companies might not have any restraint in making plastic products after this, because there's a solution to get rid of it or something like that. So I feel like it might, I don't know if it's a thing that would kind of get rid of plastic, or maybe encourage people to make even more, because now there's like a reason it's eco-friendly in a way, because enzymes will eat it.
So
these things eat plastic. The plastic doesn't go away. I mean, it's turned into something else.
But Robin, in the same way as starch that we actually eat, which is deconstructed by the amylase, it kind of becomes part of us and so on. You're right, of course, the first law of thermodynamics, matter can neither be created nor destroyed. But I think
I agree with the point that Jessica made. The fact that there is now apparently a solution is not the same as having a license to produce more of it.
Yeah, I think so.
Fair point. Exactly. Well, again, let's move on to that, and let's keep this futuristic theme going, because something that we're going to be dealing with upcoming in this particular sequence is with Professor Robert Richardson, And probably Professor Samir Neftimaziani, who is indeed the Professor of Artificial Intelligence and Robotics at the University of Salford. And I'd like to sort of involve both of you in this particular one, because apparently more than 2.7 million British people, that's 5% of the population, have admitted that they'd like a robot to dress them if they could, according to a recent poll of 2,000 UK adults. So if it was possible, a bit like the Jetsons, to actually have a robot to dress us, then we would like that. Also, the top three everyday tasks that they'd like to hand over to robots would be general cleaning, 52%, gardening at 32%, and DIY at 30%. Almost a quarter of those surveyed now think robotics should be used most for the medical sector, compared to 17% in, of course, 2017. We're talking about this because it is UK Robotics Week. So Jessica, in terms of UK Robotics Week, in which you can, if you wish, actually sort of enter a draw a robot design, I think you're probably a bit too old for that. It's actually for Key Stage 1 children. But what tasks would you like a robot to actually do for you, if you could actually say, right, you know, would you like a robot to dress you, for instance? Not that you need any help in that sort of the routine, but I'm just saying, you know, that in Britain, 5% of the population would actually like a robot to dress them in the morning.
I mean, but there used to be valets and things like that.
But he's had human beings to do his dressing for him, so.
Yeah, I think it could be, I think something like that could be useful for people with disabilities or someone who's very elderly and can't really operate in the same way that they used to. But I myself, I like a robot that could like help me find lost things, like search through stuff for me, x-ray something somehow. I don't know if there was some futuristic robot I could design, that would be it. But otherwise, I enjoy cleaning, and I feel like if I had a robot to do things, I feel like it would make me lazier. I feel like I would just have too much free time on my hands, and it would just, I don't know, doing like busy work keeps me kind of like thinking about things. And I feel like if I had a robot, I would just have excuses for him or my little robot servant to do it. And I don't know how much I would enjoy that. So I don't know. But Roombas are adorable. I like Roombas. I don't think that's AI, is it?
But Robin, obviously the first three letters of your name actually carry echoes of robot. And I'm presuming that you're not artificial intelligence, but would you be surprised by this finding? Do you think in National Robotics Week, which of course we've covered before, that this is a bit of a shocker?
If I was an artificial intelligence, a lot of the things that I say on this show and others with you would be a lot more coherent and smarter. Now, you are talking to somebody who, in the 60s, I actually did want the Lost in Space B9 robot as a friend. It never happened. As to having a robot dress me, oh no. Just no. I can put on my jeans and my t-shirt on by myself, thank you very much. And I even tie on my trainers like an adult, okay? Don't need anything to do that. Could it do various things around the house? Well, yeah. They're not exactly robots, but we have stuff to wash our clothes, cook our food, you know, basically.
Robot cleaners are very, very important these days, and robot cleaners have actually got a huge slice of the market in terms of their sensors. People have hours of fun.
But what about these people who have like extreme OCD and like to do everything themselves to a certain standard? What if the robot doesn't do it to their standard? Or what if the robot does it better and they have a complete mental breakdown? Wow.
Again, interesting lines and interesting questions, which we should actually duly put to the people respectively tying in.
And they are going to wonder, who is this idiot and what made you think he was AI?
No, it is, as I say, the sixth year of the UK Festival of Robotics. It used to be just UK Robotics Week. It runs from the 19th to the 25th of June, and indeed it's showcasing a range of free robotics events across the country.
What about you, though, Alex? Would you like a robot, and what would you have a robot do?
Well, as somebody who might have considered the whole notion of robots and the laws of robotics that Isaac Asimov put into place, I think, you know, robots have got lots of sort of positronic systems that they can do. Who would have thought over a year ago we'd be using the magic of Zoom to actually communicate, as opposed to the traditional telephone or indeed studio-based
Smart speakers.
Exactly.
AI, so just, right here, right now.
Exactly. You could even say, Alexa, tell me a joke. And it would probably say, what did the grape say when you trod on it? Nothing, just gave a little whine. And that has actually neatly brought us to the end of this little sequence.
My particular smart speaker is right next to the computer, and it was flashing. And I just thought, no, don't do this.
My brother had to take his Alexa upstairs because we kept constantly talking to it and trying to make it do random things and like play songs all the time.
Yeah, which it does.
Have you guys seen the Bloomberg news report that people are beginning to sue Amazon because they have had to admit, apparently, that that particular device does listen in and does factor into your targeted advertising? Something I've known for a long time because I do look for stuff on Amazon, and sometimes I mention stuff that I don't end up looking for, but it still turns up there. I mean, I've known it wasn't a coincidence, but now people are actually suing Amazon, according to the Bloomberg report, for invasion of privacy.
Yes, but litigation and American business go hand in hand, and we wouldn't have it any other way. Let's face it. It has become part of the American way of life.
The first person who sued McDonald's for burning their hand on a hot beverage that they had asked for.
Exactly. Yeah. Truth, liberty, justice, the American way of life, and litigation. It's five sort of classic lines that are actually there.
Time for another Zoomer on the Midweek Drive for Siren Radio and southsidebroadcasting.podbeam.com. Keeping the COVID-19 bugs at bay.
Well, it's fair to say that neither Robin nor indeed Jessica are that keen on being dressed by robots. I don't know. I think it could be quite fun in a kind of George Jetson way, but what the hate? The fact of the matter is that 2.7 million British folk admits that they'd quite like a robot to dress them if they could, according to this poll of 2,000 adults from that point of view, which is great. So that's 5% of the population. But why are we speaking about this? Well, as we mentioned, it is the wonderful time of year where we have the UK Festival of Robotics in full force, which is always great. And so we're delighted to actually welcome to the programme once again. I can't believe it's a year since we last featured him. It's the fantastic Professor Robert Richardson. I was having a 5-all XL5 moment there, Robert. I didn't know where we were going, but Robert, welcome back to the programme. How are you?
Hiya, good to be here.
You are, of course, the chair of the EPSRC UK RAS Network. Just for the benefit of our listener who loves acronyms, would you like to just explain what the EPSRC and the UK RAS Network actually are?
So the EPSRC is an acronym for government funding, and the UK RAS is UK Robotics and Autonomous Systems.
Precisely, excellent stuff. So do we cross over into artificial intelligence here? Are we looking at robots primarily, or is it just a case of, you can't separate the two?
So I think it's a bit of both. So a robot without any intelligence is just a machine that can't do a great deal. And if you have some AI or some intelligence without a physical form, it becomes on a computer and it can make nice, interesting decisions and things, but it can't do anything. So really, to make the difference that we all want, we need a fusion of these two technologies together.
Now, as we mentioned, the UK Robotics Week, it used to be, is now the full UK Festival of Robotics. So it does seem as though, pandemics notwithstanding, robots are very much with us, and we'll work through the whole process, including this sort of period, which runs up to the 25th of June. So it's designed presumably as a celebration of our mechanical friends.
Absolutely. It's a celebration of the UK and what we're doing in robotics and what we can do. So, yeah, looking at kind of all the different things that we have, which is really world-class research. And most of it, people don't really know about. It's locked away in labs and things. So this is going to be a great celebration where people can go in virtually and really do lots of different events and different things to actually see what we're doing, understand more about robotics across the UK.
I think since we last spoke, that one of the major growth areas for robotics has been in terms of cleaning. I see certainly on various websites lots of adverts for robo cleaners and robotic things from that point of view. That presumably fits in with your research in terms of finding out what do people actually want to hand over jobs to? Would it be cleaning? Would it be gardening? Would it be DIY?
Yes, so we've done some research and trying to understand what people would like robots to do. So as you may expect, half of people thought it would be great to have general cleaning for robots to do that. So that's the household cleaning, that sort of thing. 30% of people thought that having gardening robots would be really useful. And of course, DIY being the thing that's in people's minds, 30%. And I think these things have come more towards the forefront because we're spending more time at home. Certainly personally, the things in the past that I used to not really pay much attention to, working from home, and you go, oh, I should really paint that wall, or I should really do this. So people are more aware of these kind of things. And certainly for cleaning robots more generally, the idea of cleaning a space has become much more important. This is, I guess, public spaces, bus stations, airports, these kind of things. So robots have found, it was always there, but a new, stronger purpose in these spaces to keep them clean for us.
Interesting that nearly 6 million British folks say they couldn't live without some form of robotics technology. And indeed, many would actually say they trust robots more than humans to carry out a task. That's come some way away from the science fiction nightmare of, oh, the robots are going to rise against us.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that people will see robots doing useful tasks for them. And very importantly, useful tasks that are predictable, controllable. And once that happens, which is happening already, the acceptance of robotics as being a technology, it's like a technology, like a laptop, like a mobile phone. That's what it is. Once we are okay with that, then we can really unlock the potential. And there are so many things that we just don't want to be doing, dirty, dull, dangerous tasks. Wouldn't it be amazing if robots could do these sort of things? And also to tackle some of the big challenges of the world, things like waste management, climate change and crime. Wouldn't it be great if robots could just somehow make these things much better for us?
We've spoken in the past about people's favourite robots. We know earlier in the programme, Robin Pierce was saying that he was always very fond of the robot from Lost in Space, the environmental robot. I personally always had a fondness, I think, for the wonderful world of Tweaky in Buck Rogers. But from your own point of view, do people anthropomorphise robots? Do we do that as a matter of course? So even when you get a kind of robot that looks not human at all, like Wall-E, for instance, what's not to love? The environmental waste reclamation world of Wall-E. That we still kind of make that human connection with them.
Absolutely. I think we want to. It's something within us. We want to kind of have that connection with these devices. And even though we don't intend to, and we can do, of course, there are devices that are deliberately shaped or designed to be sort of human-like. But even just robots like robot vacuum cleaners, for example, I had one in the past, and you can't help but give it characteristics. And you'd come home and you'd find it clean the floor, and you'd kind of think, oh, that's good. And then occasionally it would fall over and you feel sorry for it. And even though you know, and I know everything about these things, how they work, you just can't help but give that little bit of benefit of the doubt, if you like, which is, of course, not true, but you can't help it.
Now, this is the sixth year of the UK Robotics Week. It's been the leading UK event in robotics and automated systems during those years and so on. And you've just outdone yourself once again. 165 events with 54 core events organised by the network. That was just last year. This year, there's even the opportunity to actually have a robot design and Once Upon a Robot story writing competition for children.
Yes, so there's loads of things going on. I think what we're really proud of this year is that we've been able to embrace online technology and really have lots of interactive events. And in fact, I think what we tried to do is make things that would be amazing, even if you could do them in person, you might do them online. And that's what we've been working really hard to. So being able to log in and interact with things. So we have, for example, we have first time this year, we have Robot Lab Live. You're going to be able to log in and you'll be able to see multiple labs across the UK simultaneously doing demonstrations, be able to interact with them, talk what's going on, and really sort of get like the inside view of what these labs are doing, which would be amazing. Other things I might mention, things like CSI robot investigation. So the ethics around robots is a big thing. So this is an event we're running where people can log in, they can learn about a particular scenario, and then talk through, was the robot default, was the person default, these kind of things. So yeah, loads of things where, but really the key is it's interactive things we're trying to get through this year.
Of course, we haven't mentioned one of the most significant aspects, for me at least, of robots and their boon to society, that with Perseverance landing on Mars, we've got a robot on Mars as well. So that's all good.
I think it's just amazing that we can have this technology that can do things in different planets, in different spaces. And they really have to be genuinely robotic. So there is, of course, you can remote control some robots, but when you're so far away, there's no one going to help it out. No one's going to go, oh, I'll just move that rock for you, or I'll just give you a little nudge. And they have to be fully able to do decisions in the short term by themselves. And it's just remarkable that they are actually out there exploring the world for us, or not the world, beyond the world.
Robert, what would you say would be the next big breakthrough? And I realise it's always difficult to make any form of prediction. I mean, you don't know what other sort of things are around the corner. But we've talked to in the last few days about how enzymes can actually eat up plastic waste and so on, how that can be an impactful sort of aspect. What do you think robots will be sort of working on? Will it be the environment? Will it be a case of just making our lives easier? Will it be a case of security? Where do you see robots sort of impact over the next 12 months?
So robots in the short term, we'll see robots I guess amongst us. That's one of the really primary things, getting them to be around us and doing things and interacting with us. So we're already seeing that to some extent. One of my personal passions, if you like, is robots to make the climate better for climate change. And we're working a lot in cities. So can we have self-repairing cities that are able to maintain themselves? They can clean themselves, they can stop potholes, they can repair inside pipes underground. Really to make all these environmentally damaging things like potholes and leaks and so forth go away. So we end up with this really beautiful future where we have happy, healthy cities.
There you go, absolutely. And just out of interest, would you prefer to be dressed by robots, or would you say, no, I'll leave that to Prince Charles?
I think, I mean, there is a serious side of the robots dressing, of course, people who are unable to dress themselves, but also people who just want to dress themselves. And personally, I think I would like my shoes to be put on. That's about as far as I'd go.
Makes sense. Okay, Robert, where would you recommend people should go to on the web, or indeed to locate the excitements of UK Robotics Week?
So please check out our website, which is ukraz.org, and follow links to Robotics Festival. Or people can follow us on Twitter at UK Robotics.
And we'll throw in those final two customer satisfaction questions, obviously. Robert, have you had a reasonably interesting Zoomer with us on the programme today?
I have, yes, it's been great.
So the next critical question is, can we look forward to welcoming you back in the not-too-distant future? And let's not leave it a year next time. Will you be back with us sometime?
Well, very pleased to come any time, but we'll hopefully run it again next year, the festival. But of course, throughout the year, we're pushing forward with amazing bits of robots we're doing.
Professor Robert Richardson, huge thanks. Keep on keeping on and be well.
Thank you.
Open your eyes to deadly lungworm, a crucial phrase and a crucial campaign that's just been launched by Elanco Animal Health. Now, you might well say, what is lungworm and how does it relate to my family pet? And in particular, if you've actually just taken a dog over the last few months, etc., it's fairly critical that you understand about this. So pay attention, as we're delighted to actually welcome back to the programme the wonderful vet and chief executive officer of the International Animal Charities Worldwide Veterinary Service and Mission Rabies. That's the fabulous Luke Gamble. How are you, Luke?
Hi, Alex. Yeah, I'm absolutely brilliant. Thanks very much for having me on.
Great. So let's just talk a little bit about, first and foremost, what is lungworm for the uninitiated?
Well, actually, you know what? There's loads of different types of lungworm, but the one that this campaign's about is called, it's about a parasite called Angiostrongylus vasorum, and it is carried by slugs and snails. They're the ones that transmit it and infect dogs. So when dogs go out in the garden and some of them actively go and try and eat slugs and snails, you know, which is disgusting, but they do it and then they get infected. But it's not necessarily the big ones. We can obviously see it's when dogs go out and they pick up a garden toy that might have been left out overnight, or they drink from a puddle, and then they can ingest the really tiny little slugs or the snails accidentally, and then they get infected. And in fact, the parasite can also be transmitted through the trail of a slug or a snail as well, which is, you know, quite a shocker, really. And what this campaign's about is about raising awareness of lungworm. When you've got wet and warm weather like this, you get loads of slugs and snails around. They're breeding uncontrollably. They're everywhere. And it's saying, look, if you're a dog owner, whilst we're all really responsible and we do our best to keep our pets wormed and protected against these things, many of the over-counter medications, they just don't touch this type of lungworm. They might say they protect against lungworm, but it's not this type of lungworm. And what we're doing is we're going, look, be lungworm aware. Go to your vet, chat to your vet. you know, there's a website, lungworm.co.uk. You can learn all about it there, but chat to your vet, and your vet will then give you preventative medicine, which you can put on monthly, like a spot on, which will cover against this type of lungworm, as well as your fleas, your mites, your mange. And then everyone is safe and happy and done. I mean, that's really the whole thing. It's not to scare people. It's about just to raise awareness and just make sure people are on point with it.
Very much so. I mean, it's interesting that despite the fact we spent, it would seem, the last 12 months saying, look, a dog is for life, not just for pandemics or not just for lockdown or any other sort of areas. You need to think about this. It is a serious line on this side of things. But we still see that a quarter of people have actually bought a dog or puppy with little or no knowledge. And nearly a third of new dog owners are finding having a dog a lot harder than expected. Well, no manure, Sherlock, as someone might say, if I was sort of going to actually sort of this is important to actually sort of acknowledge that, you know, having a dog, we love them, dogs are fantastic companions, they're great from that sort of point of view, but you need to look after them.
Yeah, you do. You're absolutely right. I mean, there's some staggering statistics, aren't there? I think it's 1.9 million dogs were bought over the lockdown period. And I think one in 10 households in the UK got a new pet during the pandemic. That's a great thing. Pets are just brilliant. I mean, they're brilliant. I love dogs. We got another puppy. I've got four dogs. We got another puppy over the lockdown period. We're all at home. You know,
but you're a professional, Luke. Dogs. You know what to do.
I'm one of the stats, though. I'm there. But yeah, I think the key thing is, when you get them, there's just so much to think about. You know, it's not necessarily being irresponsible, it's almost information overload. You know, it's like, well, what do I feed it? What have I got to vaccinate it against? When do I worm it? You know, what should it weigh? When do I neuter it? You know, do I get it insured? You know, all these sort of things. And things like a particular parasite carried by slugs and snails isn't necessarily on the radar at that point. But that's the whole point of these kind of awareness campaigns. They're just going, look, don't panic. Lungworm's been around since the 1970s in the UK. The incidence has absolutely skyrocketed. But a large element of that is because we're testing for it, because vets are much more aware. So we're looking for it. And that's a lot of the reason why these stats are so scary. But also, it's very preventable.
And just share with us, how can people actually sort of contact your Elanco to find out more about lungworm and the things we've been talking about today?
Well, lungworm.co.uk. It's a cracking website because it's such an easy one to remember. But if people just go to lungworm.co.uk, they can get on there, they can get all the information, they can type in their postcode and see if it's a really cool thing, actually. You can type in your postcode and just see if lungworm's in your area. And then they'll be fully up to speed with it, you know, and chat to their vet. You know, just chat to your local vet and make sure it's covered.
Have you had a reasonably interesting Zoomer with us on the programme today?
Yeah, I've loved it. It's been brilliant. Thanks very much for the opportunity. It's,
good to connect with your good self as ever. So can we prevail upon you? Will you join us again in the not too distant future?
Oh, I'd love to. I'd love the opportunity. Thank you very much indeed.
And once lockdown was announced, March 2020, one of my biggest concerns as an academic was actually not so much how we were going to get through it as academics, but also how some of my students who didn't have access to broadband or indeed technologies, etc., would cope with a pandemic. Well, we've kind of gone through the last year. But on a nationwide system, it still seems that the digital divide is arguably as wide as ever. And to talk us through one way in which we can begin to start addressing this digital poverty in a world in which everything seems to be online, we're pleased to actually welcome two fine souls to the programme today. First of all, the Director of Public Engagement at the Trussell Trust. That's the wonderful Joe Cook. How are you, Joe?
Very well, thank you. What a lovely introduction.
Okay, and we've also got from Vodafone UK, the General Counsel and External Affairs Director, Helen Lamprell. How are you, Helen?
I'm very well, thank you.
Now, Helen, if we can come to you first in terms of this particular survey and the finding that's actually there. Are you surprised by literally the fact that there are 1.5 million households still living in digital poverty?
Yeah, I think it is a pretty shocking number. I think, before the pandemic, we probably didn't think about it so much because, you know, we spent an awful lot of time talking to people about people using their smartphones too much, as opposed to focusing on the fact that not everybody had connectivity. But the issue became really obvious during the pandemic. As you mentioned, students, you know, with schools going out, we got involved in that very heavily, providing 750,000 free SIMs to schools and those in further education. But as we come out of the COVID crisis, hopefully, we're just really struck by the data that Ofcom put out about, you know, 1.5 million households don't have access to the internet, and the impact that that has on those people, whether it's children who can't get educational resources, whether it's adults who can't get online to apply for training, to do apply for universal credit, to job opportunities, or whether it's elderly people who actually, if they had access to the internet, would be able to stay independent for longer. So I think it's an issue that affects a lot of people, and given that connectivity is what we do, it's at the heart of our company, we thought this was something that we should try and solve.
Now, one of the great things that the Trussell Trust has obviously been actively involved with over the last few years, even though arguably many people would say in a civilized society you really shouldn't have to be dealing with emergency food parcels and aspects, the fact of the matter is that without the Trussell Trust's UK network of food banks, there would have been many, many more tragic cases of humanity over the last sort of year and so on. But if we can turn once more to Joe, again, the sort of things that Helen was describing there in terms of digital poverty, the fact of the matter is we live in a society where if you don't have that connectivity, I mean, certainly we couldn't do what we're doing now, for instance, with respect to just the straight interview and a Zoom thing. And so you have got a number of sort of cases where people are adversely affected simply because they don't have either the finance or the necessary technology to be able to engage with society.
You're exactly right. You know, we're now a society that really depend and expect readily available internet connectivity, whether it's for work, education, healthcare, support, being in touch with the people we love, all those things, I suppose, that so many of us take for granted. But actually, when you are a person living in poverty, it's a lifeline. It's something that you absolutely fundamentally need. If you think about having a smartphone for someone in poverty being out of reach because they just simply don't have enough money to afford the basics, to afford the connectivity. But actually, when you consider what that person wants, access to social security, being able to apply for a job, all of that rests on digital connectivity. The main way that people now apply for universal credit is all online. So what's wonderful about this partnership is it's starting to address what is a key outage for people in poverty, just not being able to afford that basic digital connectivity, which for so many of us is a given and such a key part of our lives.
Now, the strategy, clearly, as far as Vodafone is concerned, is a way of actually connecting a million people, again, a way of tackling digital exclusion. And this also brings us, Helen, to the Buy One, Give One programme. Would you like to just expand on what Buy One, Give One is all about?
Yeah, so we really wanted to bring this alive for our customers, this issue. So what we've done is we've linked this donation to one of our big propositions, which is when you buy mobile and broadband together, that's what's called Vodafone Together. And what we've done is we've said for any existing customers, we will donate a SIM to this program loaded with 20 gigs of data plus voice and text, because we think it's really important that people get to talk to people, talk to each other, keep in touch with their friends and family as well. Really important from a mental health perspective. But we've tied it to that proposition. And then, so that gives us a big, nice head start with our existing customer base. And then every time a new customer comes onto the proposition, we'll donate another SIM with the ambition that we will connect a million people by the end of 2022. It's one of those targets you almost don't want to hit it, but I'm sadly pretty sure we will hit it. So, but we think this should make a really big dent in the problem.
And in terms, Helen, of the education, because clearly, despite the fact that we might think, oh, it's just easy, you get your SIM card, you do this, and this, etc. This is also a big educational sort of task as well, because there are folk who do feel a little bit wary of new technologies. And once they actually get that digital thing, so, well, I've got a SIM card, what can I do with it? Do I eat it? No, you don't. Is it a microchip? I mean, you know, is that also being looked at as well as a way forward in terms of rolling out the ways in which people will actually use the tech?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it was one of the really interesting things during the pandemic that, you know, our shops were shut, obviously. And what we really saw was that people missed being able to come into store to ask those questions, because not everybody's, I'm not that tech savvy. That's why I love working for Vodafone, because I'm surrounded by engineers. But, you know, we can really see that with our customers as well. So, you know, we have the tech gurus in stores who will help anyone, doesn't need to be a customer. We set up a helpline for people, customer or not customers, during the pandemic, and we'll keep that support going forward. But we're also running programs with Barnardo's to help younger people who don't have those skills yet. We're also doing a project with Age UK as well, so to sort of hit sort of both ends of the age spectrum in terms of helping older people get connected and have the confidence to use the technology, because that definitely is part of the problem.
I was quite shocked to find that, according to the Trussell Trust Network, after we calculate all the sort of things such as rent, living costs, etc., basically households will have to survive on £57 a week. I mean, that is really very shocking, Joe. I mean, do you see light at the end of the tunnel? I mean, obviously, Trussell Trust is doing fantastic work to kind of alleviate some of this, and indeed this digital initiative with Vodafone is also very useful. But it really is quite frightening for what, again, is supposed to be a civilised society.
I totally agree. I mean, in a country as well off as ours, it does feel very shocking that there are households coming to our food banks who have on average only that £57 a week after their rent. And that's £57 and got to cover food, water, gas, electricity, even before you get into, you know, our topic today, connectivity. So the way we see it as an organisation, we are focused both on the here and now, so through our network of food banks delivering these extraordinarily important food parcels, but also longer term, we're campaigning for the end to the need for food banks. We don't want a society where food banks are normalised, where they're part of the everyday. We really feel that there are changes and actions that can have the impact to affect that change. It's definitely not a short-term solution. It's something that we're working towards, but it's a really fundamental part of the organisation's vision and the hope for the future.
Yeah. Helen, returning to yourself, what's the best way for people to actually get in touch or find out about Vodafone's tremendous initiative in this particular aspect? Again, I'm not going to use the ultimate irony of, obviously, if people really do need to find this, they might not be online to do so. I'm thinking about friends or colleagues or people who might sort of at least be able to access this initiative.
Well, sadly, of course, it is on the website, as you'd expect, at vodafone.co.uk/everyone-connected. But all of our shops are fully briefed on it. They're really, really excited. Our employees and our franchise stores are just super excited about this. So any Vodafone store you can go into to find out more about this project. But if you do have access to the internet going online, either to our website or to the Trussell Trust's website as well, and to find out their network of food banks, and if you get a referral to one of those food banks, they can absolutely take you through the process.
Well, again, it's been a sobering topic, a sobering aspect, and a sobering time to actually consider and ponder. But hopefully, thanks to the work of the Trussell Trust, and indeed in this case Vodafone as well, there's at least some progress being made with respect to this. Joe Cook, Director of Public Engagement at the Trussell Trust, and Helen Lamprell, OBE, of course, General Counsel and External Affairs Director for Vodafone UK. Many thanks, and keep up the excellent work.